University of California Television presents this podcast of Conversations with History, featuring Philip Gurevich discussing Reporting the Story of Genocide, recorded in February 2000. UCTV's Conversations with History series is hosted by Harry Kreisler, director of UC Berkeley's Institute of International Studies. For more information about this and other UCTV programs, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest is Philip Gurevich, staff writer at The New Yorker. His first book, We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed With Our Families, Stories from Rwanda, which was published in 1998, was a winner of numerous awards, including the National Book Critics Circle Award for Nonfiction, the George Polk Book Award for Foreign Reporting, among others. In addition to his work for The New Yorker, Mr. Gurevich has written extensively from Africa, Asia, Europe, and the United States for numerous publications, including Granta, Harper's, and the New York Review of Books. He's a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute and a contributing editor of the Forward newspaper. Welcome to Berkeley, Philip.
Thank you.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Philadelphia, grew up in New England, mostly in Middletown, Connecticut.
And how did your parents shape your character, do you think?
Well, fairly substantially.
In what ways?
I suppose all parents do, but my parents happened to encourage me to think, read, write, and look at the world pretty closely. It's a long story.
Any books in particular that you read as a young person that influenced you?
I would say that pretty much everything I read as a young person influenced me. I read a lot from pretty early on. I read a lot of I read children's books. I mean, I was influenced by Alice in Wonderland when I read Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass, and I was influenced by Dickens, which I read rather copiously in my early teens, although the endings always disappointed me. And I kept, you know, whatever I heard, whether it was the songs of Bob Dylan or whether it was things that are of no clear value as influences, like Melville, or just as much as somebody like Malraux.
When did you decide you wanted to be a writer, or did you just become make that decision?
It sort of became something that around the age of 16, I would say, I had a pretty good idea that there was nothing else I knew it ever occurred to me to do after that. I always thought it was the thing that I most enjoyed was reading books, and the only thing that made sense to me would be to somehow or other do this thing that I liked to receive.
And where did you do your college work?
I went to Cornell.
And did you do much writing there as a student to further this career, or were they completely separate in a way?
Well, I never really understood it as a career. I mean, I was writing fiction. It never occurred to me to write nonfiction or journalism. I think partly because, for the most part, nobody teaches it until you reach, say, college. Nobody teaches nonfiction as writing, as literature. You read books that have information in them, and then you read books that have information and are pleasurable, and the second category are called novels. And basically everything I knew about the world I'd learned from novels, and it didn't seem to be deceiving me too badly or letting me down. So I was at Cornell, and I kept switching majors. I ended up leaving school because I realized I want to write, but I didn't really believe in the idea of writing classes. Mm-hmm. I believed in the idea of writing practice, so I figured the thing I needed to know was whether I could actually sit in a chair and write. And so I left and took 3 years off where I basically tried to write every day. Nothing much to boast about from that period, nothing that I look back on is great stuff, but it was an apprentice period. I learned how to write sentences. I learned sort of what the toolbox was.
And what do you think is key to mastering this art? Is it just actually doing it, doing the writing?
Well, it's one thing that I think distinguishes writers from non-writers is that they're the people who write the most. But I'm serious. I mean, there are a lot of people might wish to write and forget to write and then wonder why they haven't written. Mm-hmm. Writing requires writing. I don't know what it is. There's no single key. There are many people of very different dispositions and characters and orientations and temperaments who end up being able to produce excellent prose.
Are there habits of a writer that you have to get down right? Ways of organizing your work and so on? Or it just varies with the individual?
I happen to be reading a strange little novel right now called The Lunenburg Variations, which is about chess. And in it, there's a chess master who's teaching another master to pay attention. And what he means by attention is think not that you're concentrating, but that if you make a mistake, a catastrophe will happen. The world will literally fall apart. Mm-hmm. The sun may fall from the sky. Think about it. Look, and he sends him at one point a clipping about a bus crash in which a bunch of school children are killed. And he said, that was because you were inattentive. Mm-hmm. The idea that concentration requires that much, that sense of urgency probably doesn't hurt. It's exaggerated, but I liked it as a little fable. And I suppose there is some level on which in writing, just a kind of relentless willingness to keep revisiting it, to getting it right, to not being satisfied until it's right. That varies what that means.
And so what we're really talking about is patience, too. Perseverance?
I think in some way you have to have some idea of what it is that you're trying to say in a given piece of writing. You have to have some sense of complete confidence in your fascination with the subject matter being a worthwhile thing to try to convey. That therefore, if it fascinates me this much, I ought to be able to articulate why. I ought to be able to convey that excitement. It may take any number of forms. Mm-hmm. I don't really have a whole set of rules. I just know when it's going along.
Are you suggesting that there is an element of fear and anxiousness at the heart of this process because it's so important to actually get it right?
Well, no. I mean, one's always just trying to minimize the degree of disappointment. Mm-hmm. The gap between some ideal of I'm trying to write this. I mean, one doesn't write what one means to write. One writes what one can write. Mm-hmm. And I think even the very best writers, there's still a little gap somewhere in there between the sense of I really want to somehow or other convey this, recreate the universe in this form, in this prose, and this is the best I could do. And so obviously you're always trying to shrink that gap.
How do you, once you pick the story or this tale that you want to pursue, how do you go about researching the story, so to speak, finding out all the players, the details, the environment? So talk to us a little about that.
Well, that's the other part of it. They're basically two separate activities. One's called writing and one's called reporting. And when you're doing factual nonfiction writing, there's a great deal of it has to do with actually getting the story straight. And there are many ways. One of them is just to basically, I try to approach it often with a certain degree of ignorance. I like entering a story not knowing, presuming that I don't know, presuming that I'm at sea. And not necessarily doing a whole ton of reading at first, but starting to look around and then absorb the reading almost with this idea, my God, what a lot of time I could have saved if only I'd known that earlier. But if I'd known that earlier, I would have had some blinders on about what was out there. So trying to some extent to see things fresh is always one of the greatest challenges to getting at a story. You wander into a situation, you start making calls, you start going to people. Part of it is you have to have a certain amount of moxie and just go and knock on doors. Reporting is a wonderful excuse for getting out into the world, getting out of the room where you do your writing. It's the opposite. Writing, you close off and you get in your room and sit at a desk and have to have a lot of sit power. Reporting is about asking a lot of annoying questions relentlessly.
And I guess there's a lot of listening, actually, once you find the people that you want to talk to.
Most of it is listening. Most of it is actually trying to hear what the things that you wouldn't have imagined on your own. I mean, I really basically think of reporting and factual writing as an imaginative form. One imagines the story, one sits in some place, and for some reason or other, a story appears to you, and you say, one story that for years I wanted to do was the story of the boat people from Vietnam who remained in the refugee camps in the years well into the 80s and into the early 90s, and it had been completely forgotten about. This had once been a big story after the fall of Saigon, and now it was ignored, silence, and so forth. And yet they sat festering in these refugee camps, basically in a limbo between the place they'd fled and no place would give them asylum. And I became obsessed with this story. I became obsessed with the idea of these people who put to sea in small boats, risking just an incredible amount to get away from this Stalinist regime in North Vietnam, and how we, having fought this war, had, and basically having felt bad about this war, kept forgetting that in some way we'd let the people down, or that the people who were fleeing our enemy, and that maybe there was something wrong with our enemy, even if there was something wrong with our war. All of these many complexes, plus the situation of people sitting out at sea, being attacked by pirates, engaging in cannibalism when there was no food left, getting into these shipwrecks, extraordinary dramas, All of this obsessed me, and I spent a lot of time cutting clippings, reading things, imagining it, and writing. I wrote some fiction about it. Finally, after many years, on the 20th anniversary of the fall of Saigon, so for 1994, for April 1995, I finally went on assignment for Granta to do this story. And it felt like walking into my inner life at that point. I was able to just march right in to these refugee camps and ask questions that
I see.
That it felt like I was almost talking to a world I had imagined. And at the same time, they would say things that completely astonished me because they fell outside things I'd imagined.
Mm-hmm. So that part of this work of the imagination of research is actually becoming part of the community or the individual's lives that you want to cover. So in a way, the conversation, the interview that you then have with them creates a resonance that allows you to find out more? Is that...
Well, let's say that you're going to ask people about a rather extreme situation.
Right.
You're basically asking somebody who has never met you before to tell you their life story at an intimate and intense level, to talk to you about extraordinarily charged moments in their life that they may either wish to forget, keep private, or so forth. And you, in some way, are offering them what? You're offering them the opportunity to be heard. That seems to be what attracts people to talking to reporters. Everybody thinks, like, well, at least for once somebody's going to pay attention. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, people will tell you a kind of pat recitation of their story if you ask them the normal, you know, 20 questions. Mm-hmm. But if you sometimes sit down, say, and say, okay, I'm writing this story about boat people. You are one. Tell me the story of your life. Begin with birth.
Mm-hmm.
It's a gambit. Many people say birth, and they say, well, I was born in 1943, and I left Vietnam in 1978. Well, there's a big chunk missing, but they're getting to the point. Other people, it works.
Mm-hmm.
You want to try and find the storytellers.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you do that? You do it by listening, by not filling silences, by waiting, by patience, and by starting to say, oh, but wasn't such and such going on at that time?
Right.
You realize if they were here and here and here, if these three things are part of their story, then these other things must be. The sum of those things is another possibility. Ask them about it.
So it's listening and listening in a way, because as they're telling you what maybe wrote, you're, in your responses, you're bringing them to a new level of revelation of their own story.
I don't know. I mean, yes, every once in a while one has the feeling that somebody is hearing themselves say something for the first time. And you're also looking for people. I mean, reporting is about, just like fiction writing or any other kind of writing, you're selecting the material out of a vast universe for your reader. And you talk to a lot of people. In order to write a piece in which, say, there are five or six main characters, you quite often go through 100 people that you talk to in one way or another, who give you tidbits, who make you know when you hear something exceptional, because you've heard many, many versions of the same experience. And then suddenly somebody comes along who says those things and then takes them further. And you know what you're hearing. You know that you're hearing something new. It takes time.
As a writer, we'll talk a minute about your book on Rwanda, it seems that the challenge is to move from the general notion, the general concept, what is justice? You know, what is the nation state? What is a country? Which are questions that the people whose stories you tell asked in the course of your conversations with. But that at another level, you focus in on the detail, the real human being named Paul, for example, in the Rwanda story. Tell us about that movement as a writer from the general to the specific. Anything in particular?
I mean, I think André Gide said it perfectly well, you know, expressing the general in the particular in the general. That is the drama of our lives, and he was speaking as a writer. I think, it's not hyper-conscious. The one has to contain the other and vice versa. You can't, to talk about the general generally, to me it's simply boring. It's simply inaccurate. And I don't trust it. I don't know what it means. People will say, well, you know, Rwanda, the nation state, I don't know what we're talking about here. What are we talking about? What is the lived experience of that? What are the political calculations of that? Who's making that happen? On the other hand, if you just go to people's stories and the journalistic cliche, putting a face on the catastrophe, then there's this idea almost like a postage stamp, you know. Then you're saying, here's the general and here's one individual. But it's not one individual. You have to sort of develop the relationship between an individual and an ongoing public course of events. And that, to me, is really sort of the issue that most interests me in writing, has been that place where the private lives of individuals intersect with massive historical public events, and the two become confused, and in some way one loses a fully private life because of public events.
And these are really extreme situations that interest you, the Holocaust, the genocide in Rwanda.
Yeah, I suppose some of them are a little bit quieter, though, like the boat people migration, though that's pretty dramatic as well. Yes, great upheavals, mm-hmm. really where people are, that has been what interests me. But within those also the quiet spots that involve people's lives, and to a large degree what's interested me is aftermath. I write about aftermath. I write not about the moment while the thing is happening. I go in afterwards when people are reflecting, and where there's an element of memory, and where there's also the element of how does one live with and assimilate and absorb and express an experience that's been had? What does that become?
Where did you develop this interest in extreme situations or situations like the ones that we're characterizing? Anything in particular led you to that? Or?
I really can't say. I mean, they are interesting, aren't
yeah.
they?
Yeah.
You know?
That's true.
It didn't really seem to me like I had to sort of create the interest. It was there.
So is it you're thinking about audience then?
I never think about audience.
So it's really, you know, what you find intriguing for whatever sets of reasons.
I think that, I mean, how do people form political societies and how do people individually sort themselves through massive political turmoil? How does one describe those dramas and what's at stake in them? Those are pretty interesting questions to me. Certainly the literature I've enjoyed reading, whether it's something like Man's Fate by André Malraux, whether it's, let's say, more sort of quieter books. I would say, in many ways, the memoir form that has been used by Primo Levi, whether it's Camus in The Plague, where in some way certain kinds of large public dramas are played out. I tend to prefer literature that does not isolate the individual from social and political concerns. It just doesn't seem to me that that's where people exist. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for me, Joyce is better before Ulysses when he's not all internal, where he's really dealing much more kind of explicitly.
How did you wind up doing the book on Rwanda, which we wish to inform you that tomorrow we will be killed with our families?
A year after the genocide in Rwanda, I went there. The story had been bothering me, which is to say that in April of 1994, a program of massacres began in Rwanda that ended up claiming the lives of 800,000 in 100 days. People were murdered at a rate that exceeded by three times the speed, the extermination of Jews during the Holocaust. It happened in our time, in front of our noses, somewhat before our cameras, and it vanished very quickly. As soon as the blood was dried, the story disappeared from the newspapers. Nobody really had explained it. When read the papers, it didn't seem to me to make much sense. It was described as anarchy and chaos, which struck me as implausible, simply because in order to kill at that clip requires organization, it requires method, it requires mobilization, it requires the opposite of anarchy and chaos. Mass destruction is not arbitrary. It doesn't just come about willy-nilly. Those things interested me. So in other words, I felt the story was A, being told wrong and casually and cavalierly, and that in some basic way a great calamity had happened which we were quite content to be ignorant of. And I had spent some time prior to that writing about the sort of early 90s when they built the Holocaust Museum in Washington and Schindler's List was coming out, and there was all of this very hyped up Holocaust commemoration rhetoric going around that, you know, by standing tall against intolerance, we would ensure that nothing like this would ever happen again. The Holocaust Museum was dedicated in Washington on the Mall in 1993 with this idea that this is somehow or other has a preventive function. And I thought that was rubbish. I thought it was wishful thinking. I thought it was a fantasy. And I also thought that, you know, it's sadly, denouncing evil is a far cry from doing good. And that basically it's pretty easy to take the right position on the Holocaust in 1993. You've had 50 years to be morally unambiguous about it. It's much more difficult to know how to respond, or it appears, turns out to be much more difficult for big institutions to know how to respond and governments to what's happening before us. And I wanted to look at what was happening. And I felt that in a way, by telling ourselves it can't happen again, we were ignoring it as it took place before our noses.
Now, let me just, from your own book, let me quote you to give our audience the sense of what this event was like. The numbers which you cite in the book, which I have here, that 800,000 people were killed in 100 days, 333 and a third murdered in every hour, and 5.5 lives every minute as this occurred. And then you have this a passage here, which I would like to read. Following the militia's example, the Hutus, young and old rose to the task. That is organizing and being organized to actually commit these atrocities after they were being called to arms by their leaders. Following the militia's example, Hutus, young and old, rose to the task. Neighbors hacked neighbors to death in their houses, and colleagues hacked colleagues to death in their workplaces. Doctors killed their patients, and school teachers killed their pupils. Within days, the Tutsi populations of many villages were all but eliminated, and in Kingala, prisoners were released in work gangs to collect the corpses that lined the roadsides. So just an unbelievable horror of events. And yet you go there to tell this story, and in your book you look at certain lives, and let's talk about some of these individuals who told their story to you. One that comes to mind is Paul, who winds up in a hotel and winds up responding, a Hutu who responds to events by acting in a human way to save as few people he can. How did you get him to tell his story? What was interviewing him like and so on?
Well, Paul Rusesabagina was a hotel manager by profession in Rwanda. He worked for Sabena, the Belgian National Airlines, which also has a hotel chain. And he'd worked for them for most of his career. He was the first Rwandan to rise to the rank of director general of a hotel. So he was a worldly, sophisticated businessman, essentially. I think he was a Rotarian and so on. And the Hotel de Mille Collines is the one sort of first-class, business-class kind of hotel in Kigali, the capital. And it's not a place that Rwandans generally stay because it costs about twice as much as the annual average per capita income. Which is about $80 in Rwanda. It costs about $150 a night. So it's a fancy hotel. And he was actually working at another hotel. But during the genocide, I started to meet people in Kigali who, a radio announcer who had decided not to participate in the genocidal radio rhetoric and thereby made himself an enemy of the regime, who had found shelter at this hotel during the genocide. A doctor named Odette Nyiramilimo and her husband Jean-Baptiste Gassassira and their children, whose story I became quite involved in and tell at length in the book, who ended up at this hotel. François Xavier Nzanzuera, a Hutu politician who wound up at this hotel. He was supposed to be the attorney general. Many people who were slated for death and wound up at this hotel. And for some reason, this hotel was the one place where people who were slated for death gathered in large numbers, close to 1,000, seeking refuge, and nobody was hurt. Mm-hmm. Down the street, there was a church, the Saint-Famille Church, where many Tutsis and Hutus who were persecuted by the regime also sought refuge. But there, they were picked off piecemeal, and the priest was handing them over, Father Venceslas, was handing them over to the militias. The militias were allowed into the church and so on. Nearby, there were schools where this happened as well, but the hotel was different. And slowly, I was asking these survivors, so how, why, how, what was the key to this? And many of them referred me to Paul Rusesabagina, who had been the acting hotel manager, and said, he actually used his influence very well. I said, what influence does a hotel manager have? Well, he had a liquor closet. He had the cave, the mm-hmm. basement wine cellar. And he used that to sort of bring in the enemy. Rather than keep him out, he brought the generals, he brought the heads of the militia through. When they came by, he said, would you like a little drink? Why don't we mm-hmm. talk? Why don't you, leave these people alone? He also had a phone line that he knew about, that they didn't know about, with which he used his and his considerably influential guests used it to call the White House, the French Foreign Ministry, the King of Belgium, Sabina National Headquarters in Brussels, which was very helpful, and to constantly draw attention to the plight of this particular pocket of refugees. The priest down the street also had a phone line. He never used it. He never once used it. He was busy cooperating with the genocide and embracing it. So I went to see Paul. He was in his office. The way I went to interview him, I said, "Hi, I've been told about you, and I want to ask you about it." We had tea, and he told me his story. Mm-hmm. And we started back in time. I asked him about how he'd started in life, and what is it that gave him the strength to do this. And of course, much of his point was that he didn't feel strong. He didn't feel particularly special. Mm-hmm. He felt, as he put it, "I felt that I was already dead." Many times I felt that I was already dead. And he also made it very clear that he had assumed, he had imagined, that all across Rwanda many people were behaving as he was, because it was the only sane and human thing to do. He said, "But people became fools. I don't know why. I know why I didn't, because I couldn't." Mm-hmm. So in a sense, he didn't even want to be thought of as exceptionally great or as a hero in any sense, because the only standard by which he was exceptional was by comparison with the abysmal measure of the murderer. And so he did not want to accept that you were an exceptional man for not having become a murderer. Mm-hmm. He wanted to think that they were exceptional for having become murderers. Mm-hmm. But he was very clear about it. He was shocked by how many people he knew had crossed the line and cooperated with the genocidal order without much resistance. And as he always said, they could have done as I did if they had wanted to. And I took the word "wanted to" very, very important.
So, hearkening back to what you said about the Holocaust Museum, it was less some monument to that event 50 years ago, some museum where people about it. It was actually a man living his life and seeing right and wrong in sort of his everyday life, and being able to sort of confront what was happening.
You asked me earlier why I'm interested in some of these extreme situations, and certainly one of the things that interests me about them is they tell you who's who. Mm-hmm. I mean, they are a certain kind of character test, and it's a character test that none of us can know until we're there. You cannot know. People like to go to the Holocaust Museum and say, "That's who I relate to, the guy who did right." You know, either they relate somehow to the victim and feel bad about themselves and sorry for themselves, or they relate to the good guy. You know, very few go in there and say, "Oh yeah, I'd probably have been just like an ordinary conformist Nazi murderer," right? But probably the great majority of people who go through that museum would have been, because that's what the great majority of people in Europe were, right? They were either bystanders, collaborators, or in some other way morally reprehensible positions, which are all too understandable. But there they are. But no, this museum allows you to fantasize that you're sort of morally excellent. And reality doesn't allow that fantasy much room, sadly.
Now, another story that you tell is of the minister who escaped to Laredo, Texas. And he had the opportunity to save a group who were trapped in a church. Tell us about that incident and the letter. Well, I actually have the letter here. We'll tell the story and then I'll read the letter.
Essentially, what happened in Rwanda in early April, the killings began on the night of April 6th, the morning of April 7th, 1994. And very quickly it was clear to Tutsis across the country that a kind of Armageddon had arrived, and that an attempt was being made to murder them all. And so they knew they were slated for death, as did some Hutus who opposed the genocide. And what they did was all across the country, they sought refuge in places that they thought would be sanctuaries, primarily churches, in some cases civic buildings, stadiums, schools, hospitals. But in many places, they would congregate on the churches, really, because it was hallowed ground. It was a sanctuary. And in the past, when there'd been political violence in Rwanda, these places had been respected. Instead, during the genocide, churches became the largest slaughterhouses because the killers did not respect any sanctuary. In this town, a rather typical story, Muganero, in western Rwanda, in the province of Kibuye, The church, although Rwanda is predominantly Catholic, it's about 65-70% Catholic, this area had been evangelized by Seventh-day Adventists, and there was an Adventist sort of campus at the headquarters there, and people started coming to Muganero from all around. About a couple thousand Tutsis converged on the place in the first 2 weeks of the genocide, first 10 days, and amongst those who took refuge in the church were seven or eight Tutsis who were themselves pastors in the church. So as time went by and conditions became increasingly bleak inside there, they assumed the role of leaders of the flock, as they would. They had the moral authority, the community authority. And when word came on April 15th that there would be a massacre the next day, they wrote a letter to the church president. Now, the church president was a Hutu. His name's Elisaphan Ntaki Rutimana. He was a man in his late 60s at the time. And he was sort of the authority figure in the town, and he'd been directing people to go to the church. So they wrote to him, they said, "Dear our leader, we wish you to be strong in these difficult times we are facing. We hope that you are okay. We wish to inform you that we have heard that tomorrow we will be killed with our families. And we ask you in the name of the Lord to intercede on our behalf, just as Esther saved the Jews," meaning the book of Esther and the Bible. Mm-hmm. "And we ask you to intercede with the authorities," again, "in the name of the Lord. Thank you very much." And all seven of them signed it, a kind of extraordinarily restrained, polite, deferential letter from people about to die. But instead, the pastor said, "I can do nothing. You must die." And extraordinarily elaborate testimony has been collected showing that, in fact, he ended up presiding over the massacre. And these people were right. They were killed the next day.
So how do we... What conclusions do you draw about someone like this minister?
He was a bad man. Mm-hmm. I mean, or anyway, he certainly, everything points to his, I mean, he's now under indictment from the UN Tribunal for Rwanda, and finally he did find refuge in Laredo, Texas, and then he managed to get the former Attorney General Ramsey Clark, who likes to defend political criminals, to defend him and to claim that the UN tribunal was not legitimate. And it finally, the Supreme Court cleared the way for him to be taken away to trial and extradited just a few weeks ago now as we speak. He was very characteristic of Rwandan authority figures. They basically believed in the political order. There was a tremendous closeness of the church with power. And there was a widespread belief in some way that a purification of the people could be accomplished by eliminating once and for all the minority Tutsi. I think, and that's one of the things one has to understand, that people did not engage in genocide as if it were a crime. Mm-hmm. Killing becomes the law in a genocidal society. It's not disorder, it's order. And it's an attempt in some strange and perverse way at utopia. People don't go forward to kill saying, you know, "This is the end of the world and I'm a pig and I will kill you." Mm-hmm. They go forward and they say, "This is the beginning of a better world, and I am a purifier, and I will kill you." Mm-hmm. This is going to bring harmony. And it's an exercise in community building. It's this us and them, and we will purify ourselves by eliminating you. And also, we will all be implicated, and so implication will be meaningless. And in some very deep way, this had permeated the mentality of Rwandan life in 35 years of Hutu dictatorship. It wasn't as if it came out of the blue. And the pastor was characteristic of that.
At one point in the book, you're looking at explanations, possible explanations of why this happened. You do go through a long list, and in the end, you conclude, you know, really, you can't say why it happened here and not somewhere like Bangladesh. That is, poverty wasn't the cause, this or that. So in the end, what are we left with in sort of understanding this? What happened there?
Well, I think that if one looks very particularly at the mechanisms of Rwandan life, one sees what Rwandans call the genocidal logic, the mechanisms. They understand how a small elite class that seized control of the state were the authors, as they call them, of this genocide, that they, through fear, impoverishment, ignorance of a peasant population, managed to manipulate this thing. And yet, even as one maps all of those details, even as one maps it, I like to think that some mystery remains. There is something that all of these sociological, anthropological, historical, and political mechanisms don't explain, which is a certain moral resistance to slaughtering your neighbor. Most of the killing was done between people who were actually acquainted with each other. It was not anonymous. There was an argument after the Holocaust that, in a sense, the Holocaust was the perverse result of the Industrial Revolution and the Enlightenment, because science and technology had made possible the sanitary extermination of large numbers of people, because you could sort of herd people into a gas chamber, flip a switch, and nobody actually had to kill anybody. Mm-hmm. And everybody could be like almost on an assembly line between the ghettos and the camps, funneling these people to death, and then they become smoke. Rwanda showed that technological underdevelopment was no obstacle to genocide. It was mostly done hand-to-hand, and it was mostly done between people who knew one another. That's difficult to grasp. What was that about? And I think there one has to understand that clearly there's this human capacity. It's a terrifying realization. But I also resist the idea that it's entirely normal. Mm-hmm. In other words, one has to somehow start to recognize that there is, on the one hand, the capacity, and on the other hand, it's aberrant. It's perverse. It isn't just, oh, well, you can flip a switch and off they go and kill. Off we go and kill. The general who essentially runs Rwanda since the genocide, General Paul Kagame, who's the vice president and minister of defense in the post-genocidal government, said something that made a strong impression on me in that context, which is, he said, you know, people can be taught to be made bad and they can be taught to be good. And if you look, he was saying this as an optimist in post-genocidal Rwanda. He was saying, optimistically, the same mechanisms that could be used to pervert a society to that degree can be used to influence people towards harmony. And it struck me as both the most optimistic and the most cynical or sinister remark that one could make, because it makes one conscious of how utterly malleable and adaptable people are to context.
Going back to the Holocaust Museum, this monument to Never Again had been created, but then the international community and the United States did nothing because there was evidence that something was about to happen. There were warnings from actually the general in charge of the small UN contingent there. What can we learn about the way the people outside the international community, which had the responsibility of carrying this humanitarian mantle of never again, why didn't they let it happen?
Because they didn't mean it.
What they said?
They meant it. They meant it in spirit.
In theory.
But in reality, I think that the fundamental lesson of Rwanda is that we are not serious about genocide prevention elsewhere. The whole premise of the Genocide Convention, which was written in 1948 as a response to the Holocaust through the UN, which basically says that nations will now act not in self-interest, not out of strategic necessity, but to prevent and punish genocide, implying that one would actually launch armies in a sort of to stop killing inside sovereign states. It's simply not ever happened before in history. World War II, in people's fantasies, was fought to stop the Holocaust, but it's not true. Mm-hmm. World War II was fought to staunch fascist aggression and to defend national interests on a massive scale. It's a good cause. It's not an insult to World War II to say it, but we did not go over there to save the Jews, nor did Europeans fight to save the Jews. In fact, there's every evidence that there was the feeling, well, that's the right of the Germans to deal with their Jewish problem. What we need to worry about is Germany running over the rest of Europe. Mm-hmm. And I think that there was a fantasy after that. There was a dream, there was a hope that we would act differently in the future, but we didn't. And when push came to shove, Rwanda was the test, and Rwanda basically said, no, we will not. Unlike Bosnia, where we also disgraced ourselves in terms of the sort of intervention policy of the world community for much of that time, we did nothing ever, and even in the end we didn't. And there was no strategic interest. There was no economic interest. The only claim that Rwanda laid on us was fellow humanity. And that's not enough. It turns out that the lesson of Rwanda is that that is not enough. And it's been borne out consistently ever since. We wouldn't go in there today, I guarantee you. Much as Clinton has gone over there and wrung his hands, much as Madeleine Albright has, much as Kofi Annan has never apologized. He has tremendous, and to me, it makes him, it virtually invalidates his entire career. It's one of the great stains on his career.
Specifically explain that, because you had a piece in the New Yorker about that.
Yeah. He was the head of peacekeeping operations during this. And in Rwanda, there was a peacekeeping force in the months before the genocide. And the commander of that force, this Canadian general, Romeo Dallaire, warned repeatedly and clearly that basically preparations for the extermination, that was the word he was using, of the Tutsi population were being laid into place by the government and its entourage. And essentially Kofi Annan's peacekeeping office had the attitude, just lay low. They took an extremely casual response to these warnings. They never made a fuss about them. They never blew the trumpet about them. They never drew attention to them. He then proceeded to say, well, it's the fault of the member states. This is part of the whole problem with the security arrangements of the international community, so-called, which is that the member states go to the UN and blame the UN for not doing things, and the UN blames the member states for not having empowered them. But the bottom line is that these are career bureaucrats at the UN who could do things or could not do things, and they don't do them. Mm-hmm. And finally, after always pretending, he went to Rwanda a few years ago, pursued by this story. And Clinton had gone and said, this is a disgrace on people like me. Madeleine Albright had said it. The French were beginning to start to say things like that. And what did Kofi Annan say? I have no regrets. The world failed Rwanda. This absolute abdication of personal responsibility makes one feel that the UN is actually a very, very dangerous place, because it goes around preaching accountability for heads of state. It goes around claiming that it wants to impose democratic standards, end cycles of impunity, and bring in accountability. And they are more infallible than any other institution on earth in their own eyes. They cannot be wrong. In that case, the question is, can they ever be right? If they can't be blamed for anything, how could they ever take credit for something? If they are flunkies, let's treat them as flunkies, ignore them, and hold them not accountable. And yet they want responsibility. And I find that in that drama, something terrible was exposed by the Rwandan catastrophe about the feebleness of certain international institutions.
Now, is, I don't know how I want to articulate this question, but is there the hypocrisy that you're addressing is based in an ideal that isn't realized yet, one could argue. And so that to the extent that the international community is making promises about external intervention, that is a better thing than having no position at all. But on the other hand, the best would be if they actually acted on those principles.
I would go further. In the intervention debate, I'm a journalist. Obviously, I'm an opinionated journalist to some extent after I've looked at a situation, and one tends to react rather strongly when a lot of people are at risk like this. But I'm not a policymaker. I don't have a 100% position on intervention. I think probably it's true that one has to look at it case by case, and I don't say we should always be intervening every time somebody's getting killed. What I do say is that the most pernicious story of the 90s has been the consistent habit of the United States and its partners in the so-called international community of making false promises of protection and then abandoning endangered peoples to annihilation when push comes to shove, because we don't mean to stand behind those promises. That's revolting. That's scandalous. It makes me embarrassed. It makes people dead. And it doesn't do anybody any good. And it weakens our word. Our word is no good. Mm-hmm. If somebody says, you're a lucky man, you're in a UN safe haven, you are about to get killed. Yeah. It's the most terrifying thing anybody can tell you. If somebody tells you you're in a UN safe haven, run for your life. Mm-hmm. That's a terrible lesson. Mm-hmm. So the promise seems to me to be terrible. What happened in Rwanda is here was this UN force, and if you ask Rwandans, look, it was obviously getting very, very, very hairy here in the months before the genocide. Why did you stay? You saw it coming, didn't you? Well, nobody saw it coming. They saw things getting very hairy. Mm-hmm. And all of them will say that among other reasons, it was because the UN was there. Mm-hmm. Now, the UN will say, well, we never promised to protect them all. Perhaps not, but look at East Timor. What happened in East Timor? We always say, should we intervene? We already intervened. We had the UN in there encouraging people to get involved in a risky political transition, to engage in elections. We were encouraging them to step out on a limb that exposed them to tremendous political danger. We made no provision for their protection, although they seemed to assume it. Look at Srebrenica. That's the story. It's the promise of protection that we don't mean to back up, and that makes us in some way villains in stories where we might be better off saying, honestly, you better fend for yourselves. Defend yourselves if you must.
Now, another story within your stories is the story of what happened after the genocide and the humanitarian organizations who were ministering to the Houthi refugees who had fled into what was then Zaire. Bottom, what you're describing is how humanitarian intervention to save refugees became a operation to build up the remnants of the armies that had actually committed the genocide, with a lack of self-consciousness on the part of most of the idealists and humanitarians who were there to save people.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very, the story of Rwanda as it relates to sort of international interventions and do-gooding is a very dismal story. It reflects very dismally on these institutions. In the aftermath of the genocide, several million Rwandan Hutus, about 1.5 million probably all told in the end, settled in refugee camps ringing Rwanda, the largest of them in Zaire. These camps were, from the very start, presided over by the same militias, military, and political structures that had run the genocidal regime. They became camps of the genocide. And these armies were never disarmed. These people were never regulated. Are they even refugees or are they fugitives? You know, I mean, it says the law that defines a refugee is somebody fleeing political persecution, not legitimate legal prosecution for being a criminal. And yet, we were basically, we, with our tax dollars, I mean,
we, the United States.
We, Americans, we, Europeans, but yeah, American, my tax dollar. That's part of the reason it makes one annoyed. We're literally sustaining the single largest collection of war criminals on earth and helping them rearm, fatten up, train, and start to slaughter people again. They began to kill people systematically across eastern Zaire, and they were raiding into Rwanda. They were not unaware, the people who ran these camps. If you talk to them, increasingly, they will sort of admit, gee, it was beyond us and maybe we shouldn't have done that. At the time, they knew perfectly well that something was very vulgar and amiss and very criminal and amiss. But they were basically, there is a way in which these organizations are in business. And they justified to themselves a completely untenable position. What was their justification? Look at all these poor people. If we were to withdraw, these poor people would be lost. And you say, so what happens? You're going to stay here forever? Well, no, because of course what happened is in the end they withdrew. So they were unable, they were saying, we have to stay here to save these people from themselves, i.e. from being in Africa. And in the end, what happened was finally the Rwandan government, after 2 years of warning, said, we are going to break up these camps because they are getting ready to annihilate us. And they are not refugee camps, they are military bases.
And we should explain that the Rwandan government is now controlled by the Tutsis, the
predominantly,
By the RDF, which came in.
RPF, yeah, the Rwandese RPF, Patriotic Front.
Right.
That's right.
And had control of the government now that the Hutus had fled and were trying to build a state and a community in the aftermath of the genocide.
That's right. And they had always said the refugees should come home and be included in society. And the refugee organizations basically refused to believe them. Although when people came home, they weren't all slaughtered. But they said, well, we can't let them all go home. And they couldn't figure out how to repatriate them. And of course, they didn't want to. Why would they want to? They were getting free medical care. The malnutrition rates and health rates and so forth in these refugee camps were closer to those of Switzerland than those of the surrounding neighborhoods of Africa, which did not make them popular amongst, say, the Zairean and Congolese who were living around the camps. They saw these people who had committed crimes in Rwanda suddenly taking over the area, and these people were systematically stealing the cattle and defoliating the forests and so forth, and being fed for free by the world. Well, of course, it's a good deal. Now, people say, oh, how cynical. How can you say that those poor refugees were happier living that way than being at home? Nobody would rather be a refugee. It's not true. It's not true. I mean, it is cynical, but it's a fact. And so there was something very, and it's not the only place in the world we've seen this. It happened in Afghanistan camps. It happened with the Khmer Rouge in the border camps of Thailand around Cambodia. refugee camps are fundamentally going to become political organizations, organizing places. They broke all the rules of humanitarian law, which is, for instance, refugee camps are not supposed to be established in less than 50 miles from the border of the country from which the people fled, for the obvious reason. People who flee countries tend to be opponents, at least, of the regime. Mm-hmm. And if you put them right on the border, they're dangerous. Mm-hmm. Where were they? Within a mile or two. You could see them all from Rwanda. And so this terrible situation arose, which meant that there was, from the moment that I arrived in 1995, there was an inevitable prospect of war. There was a next war. And everybody was waiting for the next war. And these refugee organizations were blindly going on, building up, fattening up this army of genocide.
This area, and in your book really conveys this quite powerfully, is a place where humanitarian idealism meets real politique, in a sense, because in the aftermath of this genocide, an all-out war essentially broke out between all the neighboring countries because of the inability to deal with the aftermath of the genocide.
Yeah.
And the humanitarian that you've just mm-hmm. been characterizing, in a way, couldn't comprehend that. So that
it can't
that
respond. Even if it could comprehend that, it basically, it's a very limited set of responses. Humanitarianism generally has professed neutrality. Mm-hmm. Neutrality in the face of genocide seems to me to be complicity. It's an absurd position. Why would anybody, what is appealing about neutrality in the face of a genocide? Mm-hmm. Zero. Yet, this was the position. Objectivity is different than neutrality, and objectivity would allow one to say, objectively, these are war criminals, mm-hmm. you see. But neutrality requires you to say, these are war criminals, have a sandwich, have a blanket, you know. Oh, is that a Kalashnikov? Please don't show it to me. Oh, you're mm-hmm. going to show it to me? Please don't shoot me. Oh, you shot me? Have a sandwich. It was that pathetic. Mm-hmm. It was that pathetic. They were basically being used like the staff at a mafia hotel.
So let's go back to Rwanda now. How does a community heal itself after such event as this genocide? There is a new leadership. Paul Kagame is a man that, in the way you describe him, appears to be someone who's very politically sophisticated and at the same time has a moral sense of the human problems that he's confronting.
He's also a military leader and at times ruthless. Mm-hmm. It's complex. How does a society reconstitute itself or constitute itself in the mm-hmm. aftermath? Slowly, mm-hmm. painfully, and uncertainly. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably the hardest part for those of us outside. We have a tremendous impatience. We want solutions. Most of the people who look at these things are either journalists on a 1 to 2 year assignment or 6 month or 6 week assignment, aid workers or diplomats who are working on similar short terms, administrations in foreign governments, and they basically want to be able to report success at the end of the year. You know, things are better, things are worse. If things are the same, it's kind of like, endless stagnation, it's a hopeless prospect. A society, Rwandans themselves, can't afford utter hopelessness. What does that mean? I mean, then it's, they have to, in some way, be struggling towards some notion that things can improve, even if the evidence is that it hasn't happened yet. Mm-hmm. It takes a long, long time. Generations, perhaps. I don't know. We are at a stage where the gap between these sort of sophisticated democracies, the advanced democracies, and the so-called transitional governments, which means governments that aren't democracies as a rule, is so vast that we forget. We think, well, we've figured this out. We'll go in there, we'll give you a blueprint, you do it. You do it by tomorrow, please, if not the next day. Otherwise, we start to despair of you and call you a criminal regime as well. How did we come about it? Through a very long process.
A civil war.
We had, well, in America, we had a civil war. Mm-hmm. We happened to have the convenient institution of slavery to build up our economy, which mm-hmm. we would disapprove of if it were being practiced in a state today. Mm-hmm. We had, endless aspects of our society in the first 50 to 100 years we would consider evidence of a collapsed or rogue state elsewhere. It was not until 1950 that we allowed for a multi-ethnic society under the law, people to go to school together. And now that we've done that, we expect societies to do it like blink. I'm not saying they shouldn't, but I think one has to have a better understanding of the actual historical and particularities of a place, and to recognize that, you know, it takes us time to overcome the loss of a family member who dies of cancer. Imagine what it's like for society where virtually every family either contains killers or victims of those killers from a period of 100 days. Fear, which is the biggest root problem of certain kinds of political manipulations, becomes not just an irrational, but a rational response. It's rational for me, if most of my family has been killed, to be suspicious of you if most of your family were killers, and not to wish to be in any way cozy with you. So people speak impatiently of reconciliation. People speak of justice. The mechanisms aren't there. The terrible catastrophe. Is that the government's fault, the current government's fault? Partly. Is it the real destruction that was visited on that country? The genocidal government and its minions sought to level that society and succeeded in many ways. Destroyed all the courthouses. Made it so that when the new government came in, they didn't have pencils, papers, chairs to sit in, much less lawyers or judges, because they had all killed or become killed. It's a very bleak prospect. And part of what's fascinating about it is really watching the effort to build from virtually zero. All the fundamental questions, what is a society and how does it work, are at play.
One final question. What was the hardest part of listening and then telling the story of Rwanda?
Over time, trusting that one knew what one had heard, that one wasn't missing out on certain things, being honest about it without being utterly depressed all the time. I mean, it's a dark story. It's bleak. Giving people the benefit of the doubt and also refusing to. Sticking with the evidence of one's own eyes. When I started writing about Rwanda, saying the things I'm saying about the refugee camps was considered extremely controversial and outrageous. It is now essentially the accepted version. Saying the things I said about Kofi Annan's and the UN's role was considered extremely outrageous and sort of renegade and, you know, well, that's your opinion. Now the UN has published an extensive report commissioned by Kofi Annan, which confirms in letter and detail and in critical language the account that has increasingly become standard. And with time, these things become standard. So in some way, having the confidence that this is what I'm seeing, this is how it is, and on another very deep level, trying to allow, you know, there was a study done that during the first 30 days of the genocide in American print media, virtually no Rwandan civilians were identified by name. So you had a faceless, anonymous mass of Africans. And what do Africans do in the American press? They die of miserable things. And here was actually what I found were living people who were highly articulate, who were in the middle of complex lives, who were in many ways what we would call bourgeois. Doctors, educated people, store owners, middle class, people with families, and trying in some way to convey in a tradition that they don't have, which is really kind of the written account like this, some of what their world was. That felt like quite a responsibility.
Any advice for students to prepare to be able to tell stories like this in the future?
Listen. Study the stories that you like reading, see how they were done, and basically look and listen. It really is that. It's looking and listening and trying as best as you can to serve what you've seen and heard.
Philip, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us and talking about your writing and about your book on Rwanda.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for joining us for this Conversation with History.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this and other UCTV programs, visit us online at www.uctv.tv.